From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about movies with David Thompson. He has a new edition of his Biographical Dictionary of Film, a lively and opinionated collection of entries about actors and directors. The book has been called a great, crazy masterpiece, as well as the finest reference book ever written about the movies. Also, we'll talk to the great sleight-of-hand artist, Ricky Jay, about his new book, Dice, Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from rapper Paul Barman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush expressed serious doubt today that Iraq would comply with the December 8th deadline requiring it to tell the United Nations about any weapons programs it has. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
That deadline is included in the UN resolution requiring Iraq to disarm. The White House insists that Saddam Hussein cannot be trusted. Now the president says December 8th will provide the answers to some very basic questions.
Has Saddam Hussein changed his behavior of the last 11 years? Has he decided to cooperate willingly and comply completely, or has he not?
The president did not say what would happen if the deadline comes and goes and Iraq is not in compliance, but he has maintained that he has a zero-tolerance policy and that the U.S. is ready to take military action if necessary to eliminate the threat the president says is posed by Saddam Hussein. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
United Nations inspectors reported finding that some equipment of interest was missing when they searched a former missile plant in Iraq today. Iraqi officials say the missing equipment was either destroyed by U.S. air attacks or had been moved elsewhere. West Virginia says it will appeal last month's ruling in the Microsoft antitrust suit. The state joins Massachusetts in asking a federal appeals court for harsher sanctions against the company. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
A month ago, a federal judge ruled in favor of a settlement reached between Microsoft and the federal government. She ruled against nine states asking for harsher sanctions against the company, saying Microsoft's behavior did not merit that action. Seven states have said they will not pursue an appeal, but Massachusetts and now West Virginia say they will press on. West Virginia Attorney General Daryl McGraw called Microsoft an unadjudicated lawbreaker and said the company should not be allowed to retain what he called its ill-gotten gains. The two states want Microsoft to change the design of the Windows operating system so users and manufacturers can easily remove new features. Last month's court ruling stopped well short of that. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
United Airlines Machinists Union will vote later this week on a revised pay cut package that's designed to help keep the airline out of bankruptcy. The union, which represents 37,000 mechanics, baggage handlers, and other workers, rejected a pay cut proposal last week. This time, union president Robert Roach says the $700 million plan addresses concerns about issues such as vacation time. The vote was announced as United said it will use grace periods to put off some of its debt payments. The payments to various creditors amount to about $875 million. In stocks today, the Dow lost 33 points to close at 8862 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 6 points. This is NPR News. Cyprus said today that it's close to agreement on joining the European Union. Cypriot negotiators in Brussels said they've finished talks with the EU on agriculture issues and have only a few budget details to work out. Of the 10 countries that are currently applying for membership in the huge European trading bloc, Cyprus is the first to come close to finishing negotiations. The candidate countries are hoping to finish talks before an EU summit in Copenhagen 10 days from now. That's when successful candidates will be formally invited to join the organization. Nearly 200 passengers on yet another cruise ship have come down with flu-like symptoms, this time aboard the Fascination, run by Carnival Cruise Lines. NPR's Philip Davis has more from Miami.
The outbreak occurred over the weekend during a three-day cruise to the Bahamas from Miami. But Carnival Cruise Line's president, Bob Dickinson, says the ship has already been scrubbed down and is ready for its next cruise. He says the company is offering refunds to anyone uneasy about going aboard.
There's something like 42 cabins have taken us up on that. The ship was full at 1,056. So you do the math, it's roughly 4% of the guests have decided to take us up on that offer and cancel.
Several other cruise ships, including Disney's Magic and Holland America's Amsterdam, have been infected by the bug as well. It's a strain of the Norwalk virus, which can cause vomiting, diarrhea, and nausea. Still no word on the source of this latest outbreak. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 2 points to close at 934. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When I interview an actor or director, I often turn to David Thompson's Biographical Dictionary of Film. It not only has basic biographical information, it offers Thompson's critical observations of the person's work. Thompson describes the book as personal, opinionated, and obsessive. He cautions that within nearly every entry, there are things that may be startling in a biographical dictionary: the sharp expression of personal taste, jokes, digressions, insults, and eulogies. The first edition of Thompson's Biographical Dictionary was published 25 years ago. A new edition has just been published. Thompson was born in London and now lives in San Francisco. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times, Salon, Film Comment, and The Independent in London. He's also the author of three novels and a biography of producer David O. Selznick. I asked David Thompson for an example of an entry in his biographical dictionary that many readers have disagreed with.
Well, there are many people I have known and many women I have known who have found my adoration for Angie Dickinson far-fetched. They're not sure whether I'm teasing or whether I really mean it, and I'm here to tell you that I do mean it. I think that in the 1950s particularly and in the 1960s, she was an extraordinary actress, and I'm deeply fond of her. I've never met her, but everything I say about her is sincere and heartfelt. I think everything in the book is heartfelt, although sometimes I think one needs to tease people a bit. And I always understood that saying Angie Dickinson was a great actress would make people laugh, but laughter sometimes is a prelude to thought.
Now, Cary Grant, you've described him as the most fascinating male personality in pictures. Why do you give him that prized spot?
Well, it's a complicated thing. I'll be as brief as I can about it. I think, essentially, it comes to this, that Grant could go from lightness and humor and charm and being incredibly attractive to being dark, secretive, selfish, unpleasant, and he could do it in a moment. He could do it in a beat. And I think, in a way, it's that kind of ease of transition that makes the most interesting people in films, to do it without going through immense antics of acting with quotes around it, but just to let your being shift. And for years, Grant was regarded as simply a movie star. I think, again, people have come to realize that in so many ways he's a very uneasy figure. We sort of take for granted now that he was very uneasy sexually. I think he was very uneasy with his fame. I think he was uneasy with being a hero and all of those things. And in his best work, and that's often the work for people like Hitchcock and Hawks, because he did his best with the great directors, I think you see that really volatile, uneasy personality.
Okay, I'm going to flip to your entry for Jane Mansfield. You describe her as the swan song of pre-nude sexuality in films. Explain what you mean.
Well, Jane Mansfield had her brief glory in an age when women on screen could not really quite take their clothes off. They could give you the indication that they were prepared to, and they could often be startlingly close to being naked. There was even a film, I think, once where Mansfield was naked for a few frames, and they had to paint in something to cover her nipples. She was intensely suggestive. And in the film she made with Frank Tashlin, who was a cartoonist who had turned into a filmmaker, nearly a forgotten figure today, she was a cartoon figure. I think, in fact, she was a good deal more intelligent than she ever appeared on screen. And I'm sure she was horribly burdened by having this immensely voluptuous body. But, you know, within 5-10 years of Mansfield's glory, it was very common for actresses to take off their clothes and for sexuality on screen to have reached into far more intimate and allegedly daring situations. I'm not sure that that's always true, but she is. She and Marilyn Monroe are sort of near contemporaries, late 50s, early 60s, and they're beautiful examples of just before censorship was going to crack.
Who is one of your favorite actresses working today?
Well, I have to say that I like Nicole Kidman more and more with almost every film I see. She's someone who, I think, in the space of 10 years has become her own woman. I think she's made amazing career choices. One of the things you face when you do a book like this is that, as well as artistic careers, people have professional careers, and in most cases they're only aware of a professional career. And some people make very bad choices. They just pick the wrong films, and you can see their career turning to ashes and sadness. I mean, I would say that, for instance, Michelle Pfeiffer has made a lot of bad choices. I don't know why, but I think she has. Nicole Kidman, it seems to me, and she's obviously had big pressures on her life of one kind or another. Nicole Kidman has made choices that I just think enlarge our sense of her and enlarge her craft all the time. There is a film coming out at the end of this year, just after Christmas, where she plays Virginia Woolf. Now, once upon a time, the idea of this young, very Australian woman playing Virginia Woolf, a kind of archetypal figure of Bloomsbury culture, might have been thought ridiculous. I think people will be amazed at how good she is in that role. So she's someone I really admire very much.
David Thompson is my guest, and he has a new edition of his biographical dictionary of film. I'm going to ask you to turn to the entry for the director, James Toback, the director and screenwriter, and I'm asking you to do this because he is a friend of yours. And for our listeners who don't know his movies include Fingers and The Pickup Artist. Name some other of his movies.
Harvard Man was the most recent. Black and White, Exposed, Love and Money, The Big Bang, Two Girls and a Guy.
Good. So this is you writing about somebody who's a good friend of yours.
Yes.
But as we know, as we've heard, you write very opinionated, critical entries for everybody in your biographical dictionary. So read us an excerpt of what you've done for James Toback, your friend.
Dear Jim, you may not know it, but you are the best friend I feel obliged to include in this book. That may be a wretched position for both of us. You are also one of the friends I most value in life. I then go on and I quote what was an original review of his first film, Fingers, which opened in 78 and which I reviewed as critic on The Real Paper in Boston. And now, picking up. Anyway, our friendship began a few days after this review ran, and it lasts, I hope. Have you known or guessed that I've never liked anything of yours quite as much, or nearly as much, since. Have we betrayed each other? Is it possible for a movie maker and a critic to be friends?
Well, let me ask you that question. Is it possible for a critic and a movie maker to be friends?
It's extraordinarily difficult, and it requires enormous tolerance and openness on both parts. And I would have to say that on Jim's part, and Jim and I haven't spoken for a few months, and I think he knows it's because I didn't like Harvard Man. So again, I'm sending a kind of letter to him over the air. I think it depends upon his generosity, and to me he has been an extraordinary, compulsive friend, someone I could never dream of giving up. But it's very, very difficult if you're a critic, because sooner or later the critic is going to offend the filmmaker, I think, and vice versa. And in the decades over which I've done this book, I've come to know many more people in the book. When I began the book, I don't think I had met more than two or three people who were in the book. I've probably met a couple of hundred now who are in the book. And some of them don't talk to me anymore. Some of them have become even friendlier, and I have to wonder whether that's because I happen to like them. It puts friendship to a very, very great test. But I do think that anyone in the arts knows this dilemma, and you have to make up your mind how far flattery and the critical spirit, how much those two things mean to you. And I try always to tell people what I think about their films.
My guest is David Thompson. He has a new edition of his biographical dictionary of film. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Thompson. He has a new edition of his biographical dictionary of film. You know, some people get into making movies or writing about movies because they love the magic of movies, and part of that magic is like the stars who make the movies, and part of the thrill of it all is the opportunity to maybe get close to them and see what these people are really like. Of course, if you're a critic and you're going to be writing bad reviews of these people, as you know, it's not necessarily going to endear you to them. Was that ever part of what you wanted? Did you ever want writing about movies to be like your foot in the door to get to actually meet the people who make them?
Oh, yes. I think that was something. I mean, I was born and raised in England, and for a large part of my life, America and Hollywood were literally places that existed on a screen. And I fell in love with America through the screen, which is probably because I was lucky enough to be a kid watching American movies when they were pretty good, late 40s, early 50s, that time. I never dreamed I would come to America, much less go to Los Angeles. And I know when that began, when I began to sort of go on the sets and meet people, it was enormously exciting, but very frightening too, because it was really like stepping into a dream world, and it has probably filled me up for good. If I never stepped on another film set, I would not be upset now. But what it has done is leave me with a great desire and interest to write about the way business affects the art in American film, because I think still to this day that is not fully understood. The money is so powerful. I think there is literally a way in which even the great artists we might like to name in American film do it for the money. It's almost the only way to survive there. And I find that a fascinating subject, and I hope one day to write a book about that. But I've met enough actors and actresses by now, yeah.
We know you're talking about how money affects movie making. Years ago, I think it was in the 80s, you wrote an essay about why screenplays are so bad, and your answer to the question is nobody reads them.
Mm. Really, nobody reads in Hollywood at all. I mean, that is something that you learn when you do a book like this, which has some harsh things to say about certain people in Hollywood, and years later they will come up to you and embrace you and tell you it's a hell of a book, a terrific book, and they've not read it. And Hollywood is not a reading community, I think, on the whole. And I'm not sure that it ever was, but there was certainly a time when people wrote scripts to be read. There was a quality in the dialogue in them, for instance, that alone begged to be read, and begged to be read aloud sometimes. We don't have very many people left who can do dialogue like that.
Well, how can screenplays not be read if a screenplay is going to be made?
Because the screenplay is a concept. It's a package. And people will tell themselves, well, no need to read the screenplay yet because we're going to rewrite it anyway. What I need to know is the concept. And the concept is, let's say, Tom Cruise and Leonardo DiCaprio together, action film set in the South Pacific. We might bring it in for $110 million. Now, those are the vital things about the concept. If someone whispers in your ear, but you know the screenplay is really not very good yet, you say, well, don't worry. We'll doctor that. If it's a Tom Cruise film, Robert Towne probably will have a moment where he'll go over the script and he'll turn it smooth and he'll turn it into gold. No need to read the script yet. And it sounds like a preposterous and far-fetched notion, but I seriously mean it, that scripts are always changing. Sometimes a movie never has a finished script. And because of that, certain people feel they never need to actually read the script in detail. They will get coverage on it. They'll get reports on it. They'll ask other people what they think of the script, and there will be a sort of word-of-mouth estimate of the script that circulates around a film. But then next day you'll get new pages, so nobody settles on what the script really is or what they think of it.
You know, Todd Haynes has a new movie that I think is very good called Far From Heaven, and it's an homage to the movies of Douglas Sirk, who made the movies Magnificent Obsession, All That Heaven Allows, Written on the Wind, Imitation of Life. You have an interesting entry on Douglas Sirk in your biographical dictionary of film. Would you talk a little bit about what you see as Douglas Sirk's style and importance?
Well, Sirk was a very interesting figure. He had come out of German theater, and he came to America in the late 30s, and he gradually found his way to Universal, where in the 1950s he made a series of very successful, what are called women's pictures, pictures with Rock Hudson, Jane Wyman, people like that in them. He was a great stylist. He loved color, he loved decor, he loved camera movement. And those people who just love film style for film style's sake adore Sirk and were in raptures, as I was when Far From Heaven unpeeled on the screen, because it isn't just a homage. It's as if Todd Haynes has become Douglas Sirk almost for a moment. It's just breathtakingly beautiful. The colors in the film are put together with a kind of boldness that really no one since Sirk or Michael Powell has dared to do.
We usually use the word melodrama in a very dismissive way, like, oh, it's just a melodrama. In your entry for Sirk, you sing the praises of melodrama, and you write, long live melodrama, and let us stress the quality of Douglas Sirk. What do you think of as melodrama? Like, what does melodrama mean to you, and what was his approach to it? Yeah, go ahead.
I'll tell you what melodrama is. Melodrama is going in out of the daylight, paying money to sit in the dark, packed in by strangers so that you feel you can't get out, in front of a screen the size of an ocean liner, where the screen is filled with a tear dropping from a woman's blue eye down to her red mouth. That's melodrama. It's in the nature of the movies. It's sitting in front of a screen where you know that quicker than you can close your eyes, the image can change from, say, the one I've just described to an image of a knife tearing down that woman's cheek. It's the basic melodramatic condition of not knowing what's going to happen next and longing to find out. And so long as that lives, movies will live. When people feel they've seen it all before and therefore are not surprised, are not shocked, not delighted, not moved, and maybe we're there already, that's when movies are in danger of fading away, I think.
As a practicing critic yourself, what do you think of the state of film criticism today?
I'm not really what I would call a practicing critic. I don't
because you don't review movies on a regular basis.
I don't review
right.
movies, and I don't think I'm actually good at it. Whenever I've done it briefly, it's not worked terribly well. I think I'm much better at thinking about movies over a period of time and then writing about them later. But to address your question, I think that we're in a bad, bad time for the movies, and I pray that there's a young generation coming. Sometimes you get the feeling that with the Andersons and people like that, Alexander Payne, Spike Jonze, there could be a really new, tough, irreverent generation such as came into being in the 1970s in America. I hope that's going to happen. I would have to say, though, and I don't think I'm the only film writer or critic who would tell you this in honesty, that going to the movies all the time gets tougher.
But what about the state of film criticism?
I think film criticism barely has a state at the moment, I'm afraid to say. I think it's a reflection of the times. I think it's a reflection of a culture in which thumbs up or thumbs down has come to be the central way of relating to a movie. I think advertising, where you don't even know the names of the people being quoted, and it's no surprise to discover sometimes that some of them were invented. I think people feel extremely distant from film criticism, and it's been such a terrible falling off since the great days of Pauline Kael, who, whatever you think about her, she made film criticism central to the American intelligentsia. Don't think that obtains anymore, and it's a real sadness for those of us who have followed her.
David Thompson has just published a new edition of his biographical dictionary of film. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The great sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay is also a scholar of magic, con games, and sideshows. Coming up, he talks with us about his new book, Dice: Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new rap album from Paul Barman. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ricky Jay is a master sleight-of-hand artist and a spellbinding performer. His one-man show, Ricky Jay on the Stem, which he recently performed in New York, and his earlier show, Ricky Jay and His 52 Assistants, were directed by David Mamet. Jay has acted in the Mamet films, House of Games, Things Change, The Spanish Prisoner, State in Maine, and The Heist, as well as the films Boogie Nights and Tomorrow Never Dies. Ricky Jay is also a scholar of magic, con games, and sideshows. He's the author of two histories of unusual entertainment, Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, and Jay's Journal of Anomalies. His new book, Dice, Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck, is a series of reflections and historical anecdotes about dice. The book also features photographs of dice from Jay's personal collection. These don't look like ordinary dice. They are old celluloid dice, and they are decomposing. Ricky Jay, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want you to describe what the decaying dice look like.
Boy, it's actually difficult to describe, but over a period of years and years, dice which are made from celluloid nitrate in this case, which was the industry standard probably up till about the middle of the last century, eventually begin to break down. And they break down in the most amazing ways. I mean, they start, you see crystallization on the corners of the dice, and they move to the edges, and eventually fissures occur and stress and imploding of dice where you can wind up with actual crumbling pieces with the paint used to mark the pips on the dice moving with the dice taking absolutely extraordinary shape where the colors change, where material which might have been in the dice, both in the makeup of the celluloid, which would be cotton fibers and camphor in addition to sulfuric and nitric acid, but also if the dice were, adapted for use by cheaters. So if there were things within the dice, you may see them coming out. You may see oxidation. And this series of photographs which Rosamond took were absolutely stunning. I mean, just stunning.
I want to add that on some of these decaying dice, you actually see mold growing, and there is something so creepy about it. And I think part of what makes these photos so exciting to me is that they're inert substances that are dying as if they were organisms. And it's almost like a definition of surrealism. You know that surrealistic image of the cup that is fur-lined?
Oh, yeah.
This is what these dice remind me of, this like almost unholy combination of inertness and life. How did you start collecting dice?
Well, I suppose one could call them tools of my trade. I mean, as a sleight-of-hand artist, both magic and gambling techniques often involve dice, and so they're wonderful objects. And over the years, I realized, without consciously trying to amass an enormous collection of them, that I did have thousands of pairs of dice coming from disparate sources, from gamblers who reformed and took to other fields for their financial support, from collectors, from friends who would give me dice. And eventually I had many of them. And over the course of years, this breakdown of the dice, this decay and exposure, managed to make them create these unusual, incredibly unusual objects.
When you started collecting dice, did you have any idea that they were going to decay, or did they just surprise you and start doing it?
No idea at all. It was a complete surprise. I mean, I had seen dice in various states of decay. And, of course, older dice, really old dice, bone dice, ivory dice, don't decay in this way. This is, a man-made process. Celluloid is the first commercially successful manufactured plastic. So I suppose it should have a fate that suits that.
Now, these dice made out of celluloid, they disintegrate for the same reason that old celluloid film disintegrates, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, the photographer says that these dice smell also. Do they smell a lot?
They do. And I must say, keeping them in my house for a period of years, I would occasionally, at the request of my wife or various other visitors, have to move them into more secluded areas. I kept them in largely in old plastic drawers and in a cupboard, and then you would not notice this rather odoriferous eminence. But if you took them out of the drawers, you certainly would.
How have you used dice over the years?
Well, just as objects to conjure with, I suppose, is the best way to express that. There are lovely effects that can be done with dice. Mysteries, effects of skill, and if one were choosing to talk about gambling or hustling, you could demonstrate, in fact, various things that could be done with dice.
You quote your grandfather who said that he was a magician, and he said he never played with cards because if he lost, he was thought to be an incompetent magician, and if he won, he was suspected to be a cheater. I was figuring that would probably be true with dice also.
Well, it is. I think I actually mention it in that aspect in the book because of the same thing, of people being suspected of being cheaters if they simply won. I mean, that bears to mind one of, I think, the most interesting anecdotes in the book. In 1544, we find the first serious account of cheating with dice in the English language. And of all places, it appears in a study on archery called Toxophilus by Roger Ascham. And in it, he talks about what I think is just a truly diabolical method of a cheater gaining his advantage. So he says in this particular game, a man that the cheaters want to take for their money is actually winning honestly. So what they do is to switch false dice into the game. Let the honest man throw the dice once and accuse him of cheating and then take his winnings. And that's in 1544. I mean, the level of duplicity is just wonderfully modern.
How are loaded dice made? Like, what's the principle there?
Well, the principle is that a foreign substance is placed into the dice at some specific spot to make it favor the throwing of certain points. So I think that's a reasonably accurate analysis of this, so that if it's heavier on one side, it'll make that side would tend to be thrown to the bottom so that the opposite side would surface. And various materials could have been used over the years, lead, gold, quicksilver, mercury. And then the placing of these loads within the dice became more and more sophisticated.
And what are the first forms of dice that you found in your research?
Well, I think it's pretty safe to say that dice come from astragali, which are the heel bones of hoofed quadrupeds. And this particular bone was quite attractive and six-sided and took well to decoration. And they say that the heel bone of the antelope was particularly handsome, and that was really prized by the throwers of astragali. And we think that only four sides were actually used in these dice games. And the evolution from astragal to dice is, at least to my knowledge, not based on any single event, that it takes place gradually over a period of years and years.
You actually reprint a quote from, it's a craps dealer, and his wrapper has come on. Do you have your book with you?
Yeah.
Could I ask you to turn to page 38? Maybe you know this by heart.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do this for you.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, get your money down. It's betting time. The hard 6 and the hard 8 gets you 7-1. The hard 10, the hard 4 gets you 8-1. I repeat, get your money down. It's betting time, and we're off. Coming out for a point, bet the big 11. 7 is a crap. Bet the field. They come or they don't come. 5 and after 5, the field. They come or they don't come. Leave your money set and win a big bet. Don't cut it thin or you won't win. Leave it go and watch it grow. And the winner, 5 on the front line. And we're coming out for another point. Iolev, the winner.
What year is that from?
Boy, I would guess that's probably the litany of a craps dealer in the 50s or 60s. You know, just somebody doing their spiel trying to get someone to lay down money in a casino situation.
Are there many casinos where you have people who can do the spiel as well?
I think that becomes a dying art. It's very much like Carney, which we've talked about on past shows together, that the language of the Carney and the Carney come-on has changed enormously, that you used to have an outside talker, someone that would do the pitch, and that they would repeat this pitch over and over again. And the very concept of that has basically been replaced by a tape-recorded loop. And I think in large casinos, people think, certainly in the really classy casinos of Vegas, that a spiel like that is somehow an unfair inducement to bad betting. So I think in both cases, they're dying out, sadly.
Why do you think the underworld and illicit activities have always had their own language?
Well, this becomes a very complex question, and one for someone whose skills are in areas other than mine. But I think the general thing that you hear is the idea that this language is used to be exclusionary. But I think people who study this carefully will tell you that's rarely the case. Perhaps the only thing that comes to mind as an absolutely exclusionary use of real language is the language of the pickpocket, where the pickpocket, the hook, the wire, the dip, the cannon, the man who actually takes the wallet, talks to his shill, his confederate, his stick, his stall, and literally gives him directions in actual conversation that would allow the stall to know where to set up and what pocket the dip wants to reach to take the wallet away. And the idea that that actually happens during the transmission of the crime is pretty wonderful to me. But it's the most specific example that I can think of.
So that they can talk in code and no one will understand.
Right. And then the concept of the office, which is giving a signal. It's a wonderful 18th century term that's still used by gamblers all the time. It's a method of communicating from one gambler to another. It could be silent. It could be through language. Now that I say that, it can be used in a Monte game with the operator telling the shill by language. The shill can't follow which is the actual card to be chosen, you know, where the queen is amongst the two black sixes. And so the operator, in the course of doing his spiel, will actually manage to tell the shill which card he should bet on.
Before you became a master of the con game and a historian of the con, were you ever taken? I mean, when you started to really love this stuff, before you knew how it worked, did you play three-card Monte and lose all the time? Did you play dice and with people who were cheating but you didn't quite know how, so you were losing?
Let me say that I have been in card games and games of chance in which people were moving. That's the correct term. People were absolutely moving. And sometimes you can determine it while it's happening, and other times you might have to go back after the game and recall, aha, that must have been what happened in this situation. I think anybody who thinks that they can't be cheated in a game is the perfect person for you to play against.
Why?
Because they're clearly suckers. Anybody can be cheated. I mean, they're just levels and new work that's being done all the time.
My guest is Ricky Jay. His new book is called Dice: Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ricky Jay, the great sleight of hand artist and the great historian of magic, conjuring, and anomalies. He has a new book, which is called Dice: Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. Your Journal of Anomalies, which was like a very handsome, almost newsletter that you would occasionally publish featuring anomalies, freaks, and freaks from history, unusual performers through history. You collected that a while ago into an actual book. Why are you so interested in people who would be known as freaks?
Well, I think I sometimes say that I'm not so interested in people who were just, for instance, Siamese twins don't particularly interest me, but Siamese twins who play the violin interest me enormously. It's a bit glib, but I think you see where I'm going.
Right,
that,
exactly.
That I really am interested in people who would overcome extraordinary difficulties and become, you know, just absolutely fascinating people. One man who actually crosses over to both books is a man we've talked about before, Matthew Buchinger, one of my true favorites, a man who was born in 1674 and was only 28 inches tall and had no arms or legs. and was an extraordinary magician, which is how I got interested in him. But he also played more than 8 musical instruments and danced the hornpipe and did trick bowling shots and fired pistols. And he also was a dicer. Matter of fact, I have this couplet about him in the book. He throws the dice as careless down as any gamester in the town. And though the number cast be 3, 2 sixes you shall ever see. So the idea of this 28-inch man who was actually had no arms or legs, but he had two. Well, I guess the easiest way to describe his appendages were like the thalidomide flippers that we saw in this country some 20 or 30 years ago. But his enormous accomplishments are just absolutely intriguing to me. And he also, amazingly enough, was an extraordinary calligrapher. And I've managed over the years to build up a collection of original pieces of his calligraphy, often done on vellum, sometimes on paper in the early years of the 18th century. And because they were so good, they were saved, and I've been able to put together a rather remarkable holding of this. But I think he may be the man that I'm most interested in the world. I mean, it's just such an extraordinary level of accomplishment, and also in an age where these people were exhibited in horrible situations. Here was a man who was allowed to have a real education, you know, who had an interesting family life, who had many descendants who became accomplished in their own rights. I think his grandson was at one point considered the best lute player in England. Buckingham himself had 4 wives and 14 children. So he's just, to me, endlessly fascinating.
Where do you go to learn more about him?
Well, I don't know. I suppose every time that I'm on the road, this is one of the pleasures of my life. If I'm in a city performing, I manage to go to libraries and museums and bookstores and print shops in search of material. And in that way, I've been able to unearth a lot of material about him and various other people that I write about as well.
Do you think there's any contemporary equivalent of the Freak Show now?
Well, there still are some shows like this running. And you know, a man named Ward Hall, another man named Bobby Reynolds still put on shows like this that are great fun. And, you know, it's considered a dying entertainment on the level that there are far less of these shows than there once were. And politically, they're rather peculiar as well. But often, one has to talk to the person who's being exhibited, and often those people feel like they have an honest way to make a living and are not being exploited at all. But this is a difficult political issue. I mean, I love this world, the world of the carny.
Ricky Jay, you just finished a 7-month run of your latest show, Ricky Jay on the Stem, in New York. What was this show like? I'm sure you'll be doing it again.
We have had some offers to do it on the road. At the moment, I'm in need of a serious rest. But it was a show based on, I guess, the deceptions and old entertainment of Broadway itself, on the Stem being a slang term for Broadway that was particularly popular in the teens and 20s. So it dealt with the literature of Broadway, the entertainments of Broadway, the cons of Broadway. And it was a full evening that I did, you know, with David Mamet again, who directed it and came up with many a fine line, and with a marvelous group of people who were involved in helping with this show on every level, wonderful designers and stage crew.
What kind of cons are involved with Broadway outside of selling tickets to a bad show?
Oh, well, in the sense of cons that might have appeared on Broadway, so things like three-card money or the endless chain or, you know, various hustles that might have taken place in front of the recruiting booth on Times Square and a little Damon Runyon, a little Joe Mitchell, you know, just for color and feel. It wasn't specifically about the idea of scalping tickets at all.
No, I figured. Ricky Jay, could you perform an excerpt of your show on the Stem?
Well, I'll try to do the opening for you.
Great.
Welcome to the Stem. The Stem is Broadway. Broadway's the heart of the city. It's where the three roads meet. It's where Oedipus met his father. It's where the bus from Minnesota meets the Minnesota Strip. It's the pimp, the pickpocket, the Murphy man, the old recruiting booth on Times Square, Tootshore's, Sardi's and Lindy's, quick before they turn it into Disneyland, Mr. Professor, please.
Oh, so great. You can really write in the style of the old Carney Come On.
Thanks. It's great fun for me, and great fun for me to work with David Mamet on this sort of material. We really do love it, and I think we've had some success in trying to get that feeling across to the audiences who seem to enjoy the show. I sure enjoyed doing it.
Well, Ricky Jay, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, thanks very much indeed.
Ricky Jay, his new book is called Dice: Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new rap CD by Paul Barman. This is Fresh Air. The most visible white hip-hopper is Eminem, who's much praised for his verbal dexterity and vivid scene setting, as well as being condemned for misogyny and homophobia. But there's another white rapper, MC Paul Barman, who could be considered the anti-Eminem. Rather than seeking to appear streetwise and tough, he raps about his large vocabulary, bad schools, and his crummy sex life. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Barman's new CD, called Paul-aluya, is both amazing and annoying.
All right, so you're going to
do an intro right now.
Yeah. Do it right now.
Yeah, you know what
I'm
saying?
Right now, you got a measure left.
Hey.
Quickly. You got a
measure. No one can. Yo.
All right, rip it.
I make death tunes, take from MF Doom and Jeff Koons. No one left for the restrooms when I got on stage. I can rock the mic to Silence by John Cage with the arty flavor. I shoot the gift like a party favor. Flip the script and make it do cartwheels. Feel smart, steal hearts, and start meals with chocolates.
There aren't many rappers out there who name-check the artist Jeff Koons, composer John Cage, and proclaim a bit later in that song that he's iller than the Iliad, and boast, I'm the Ne-plus ultra, a B-plus culture. But does all that make Paul Barman good? Barman makes much of his pedigree as a Brown University graduate whose nerd persona renders him a hip-hop Woody Allen. He's a whiner who gets the girl, a Jewish outsider having fun with couplets that make fun of wasps as, quote, smirkin' jocks with hacky sacks in Birkenstocks and khaki pants. Barman is a privileged outsider who writes songs that put down the low standards of public schools.
Current events, comparison contrast, cause and effect,
embarrassing bombast. Five paragraphs, each start with a topic sentence or hook for pop a sentence. So much plop, of course people stop attendance, and this court loves to drop defendants. Let me leave an illusion dispelled. 98% of the graduates matriculate because the other ones got expelled.
Paul Barman doesn't merely rhyme. He writes eight-bar palindromes. He writes about having sex with famous women, but his list includes not just predictable stars like Winona Ryder and Elizabeth Hurley, but he insists that distinguished essayist Cynthia Ozick is also an object of his desires. The high and low culture references just cascade out of him, especially when he's talking about sex. To put it as absurdly as Barman himself might, if the novelist Philip Roth and the critic John Leonard had a child, he might sound something like this.
I'm truly the hero of Julie Shapiro, but I'm sure to spill sperm in Laura Silverman. I'm sticking taxing long things in Maxine Hong Kingston, which brings in Amy Tan. She said, Lamy Mon.
The problem with this CD is that its beats and rhythms don't equal its verbal inventiveness. This results in a certain sameness that eventually grows wearisome. As Paululia proceeds, Barman becomes less like the hippest Jewish rap act since the Beastie Boys and more like Weird Al Yankovic, a novelty artist, Stan Freeberg with Flo.
People repping clones accuse me of doing rap as a stepping stone. I thought about this crap when I was schlepping home. It's cause I went for the laugh, cause I'm not from the Ave, cause I target the fans that you wish you didn't have. Had I made a mockery of a culture like the Choco Taco? Was I to rap as France was to Morocco? Was I colon rap colon colon France colon Morocco?
Paul Barman has said he's making music for, quote, people who are like a 16-year-old Paul, really, really bored with their environment, rebellious inclinations toward authority, anxious about the future as it was predicted, a desire to jump on your pretty friends, unquote. In all this, he succeeded, I think. It's just that being a freakishly articulate, hyper-16-year-old is also a textbook example of arrested development.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Paul Barman's new CD, Paululia.
Is my distance from the mic proper?
Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
There's a college town with olive green all around. Professors and skate punks rock SD Paul's ball of sound, and there's an anarchist bookstore. That's more than you look for. Core of local folks wait for late lift. There's often a great drift to the shop for the Wednesday night 5 to 8 shift, cause the clerk at work is the prettiest gal in town. She cries during Allentown, a precocious socialist, and she's willing to pal around. She's twice as cool as the kids from her high school, and every Wednesday after French club she used to work with stuffed mastodon in the basket on her bicycle. If Noob Chomsky was from the Bronx, he'd have been assassinated promptly. She said he was from the Bronx. He said, you know what I mean, ignoramus. Oh boy, what a pain this is. So the only paid employee, the manager came for culture, not accountant. And a girl put a flyer up above the water fountain. She carried clandestine $2 mescaline, and her blue collar method plaster with stickers that said food not bomb, sex not bomb.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing nearly 3 million members with customer focused financial strategies and service. Online at thrivent.com. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Elizabeth Newfer, foreign affairs and UN correspondent for the Boston Globe. She just completed boot camp for journalists preparing to cover war in Iraq. She leaves for Iraq December 8th. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.